Welcome to the Nordic Food Tech Podcast. On this show, we share the stories of how different actors up and down the value chain are working to take climate action through food. It's all about inspiring collaboration, discussing the good that is happening, the challenges we share, and realizing a common vision for our future food system. I'm your host, Annalisa Winther, and let's jump in. My guest today is Melina Abelson. From 2009 to 2013, Melina was a member of the Greenlandic Parliament. She first served as the Minister of Social Affairs and Equality, and then as the Minister of Finance. She's been the Chief Commercial Officer for Air Greenland and the CEO of the Arctic Winter Games. Before that, she worked in the UN Human Rights Commission in Geneva and for the Directorate of Foreign Affairs in Nuuk. Today, she is the head of program at UNICEF in Greenland, a member of Greenland Bank's board, and the chair of the board of directors at Royal Greenland. We recorded this episode live in the capital of Greenland, Nuuk, as part of the Unleash Regional Innovation Lab, which gathered 200 people under the age of 35 from the Nordic and Arctic region to discuss and come up with solutions to the common challenges that our region is facing. We had three main focus areas, which were climate and biodiversity, education, as well as health and well-being. If you've been listening to this podcast for a while, then you know that this show and its conversations focus on how we can heal the earth through food. In this episode, we take a look at how our world is deeply interconnected and how we must look at and consider the whole when coming up with solutions. Food can be an incredible healer for us and the planet. I'm sure you've seen the power of food in your own life. I am very grateful to Melina for taking the time to join me in this conversation. Our Indigenous communities hold so much valuable knowledge, and for me, this conversation, as well as the entirety of the Unleash Lab, demonstrated the power of gathering, listening, and the powerful solutions that can emerge when we combine ancient knowledge with modern science and technology. I would love to start the conversation today with a little bit of an introduction to who you are, meaning where do you come from, both in your work, but also where you were born.
I was actually born in Denmark because my father was working in, and my parents were living in Denmark at that time. My mother is from West Jutland, and my father is from the south of Greenland, and they met at high school. My father was sent abroad when he was about 16, and they met each other there. And I was born in 76, when my father was working for the Greenlandic Ministry in Denmark. And my mother, she's a teacher. I don't remember, so, but when I was 3 years old, we moved to Greenland. I grew up here in Nuuk, and until I was about 16, and my mother was a teacher for like 35 years here in Greenland, and my father was, he was working when in politics, he was a lawyer, and been living abroad for 12 years. I did my studies in Denmark and in Australia, and then I went on living in Geneva. I worked in specifically with Indigenous people's rights at the High Commissioner for Human Rights. And then after 12 years abroad, my father died here in Greenland, so I decided, I don't know why, but to return just right after he died. Because it was like my mom, she has already moved to Denmark. He died because of illness. And then it was like, there's no one back home. I need to go home. So I left Geneva and moved back in 2005. I am a sociologist, bachelor and candidate and master in sociology. And I've been doing lots of different things. I've never had a career plan. I know people say you should have that. I've never had that. So I was working with Indigenous people's rights and mentoring young Indigenous people from all over the world. But when I came home to Greenland, I did something I thought I would never do. I went into politics. It wasn't because I wanted to, but because I just truly felt that I had to. And that was mainly to coming back and realizing if I'm going to live here, I'm going to have to do something different. So it was in particular due to children's conditions that I went into politics. And I was one of the first Danish-speaking politicians. I mean, I grew up here in Nuuk, but when I went to school, we had two different classes. There was the Danish-speaking class and the Greenlandic-speaking class. So we were very segregated back then. And I grew up in a time where everyone said, it's not important for you to learn Greenlandic. Even my father said to me, oh, it's so much more important you learn German, etc. And then I was like, wow. And it changed. I know it changed a lot. So I never really learned Greenlandic fluently, which has been a big grief and also something that has been giving me limitations later on in this country. But then back in 2009, I decided to run for the parliament. And I was so scared because it was like, I'm Danish speaking. People are going to say I'm not Greenlandic enough, etc. But it went well. And we were two ministers at that time that became ministers that had Danish as our mother tongue. Wow. And then I was the social minister for 2 years and finance minister for 2 years. And then I went on to work with something called Arctic Winter Games. It's bringing children from all over the Arctic together in sports and competitions, sport competitions, but also cultural, interchange and different projects. And I was there for 3 years and we had like 2,000 visitors in Nuuk, and that may not sound like a lot, but in a population with only 56,000 people, it's a lot. And then I went on to something completely different, which was aviation in Greenland, Air Greenland, how to access even the smallest community to the international flights as well.
The chief commercial officer, right?
Exactly, mm-hmm. Yes. And then I moved on to work with UNICEF, and it was a bit like coming home because I came from human rights and the UN, and then I came back, well, not came back, but I started at UNICEF 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And I do also have a little bit, or quite a lot, to do with fishery because I'm the chair of Royal Greenland, the biggest company, fishing company here in Greenland.
Yes, you've been busy.
Busy.
And why I wanted to speak with you today is that we are in Greenland and we're at the University of Greenland right now in Nuuk. And we are here as part of the Unleash program, which you've also had a hand in. And we were selected as 200 young talents under the age of 35 from all across the Arctic, meaning Canada, Alaska, Norway, Finland, Sweden, Greenland, the Faroes, and probably even some other places I'm forgetting, but the entire Arctic Circle, to talk about three particular SDGs or issues, and that's climate and biodiversity, education, and health and well-being. And looking at your resume, as you mentioned, you've been in business, you've been in politics, you've been in many aspects of the society, and I wanted to take the time to relate what we've been learning here, but also learning more about the work you do in the day-to-day and how the ideas we've come up with here can, you know, relate to what you see unfolding. And you mentioned the Arctic Games, and I think that's a really good place to start because we had a demonstration of some of the Arctic Games. And in that moment, I also realized that I was looking at the map in a new way, meaning we're very used to seeing the traditional map we've always seen, but we were shown a map looking at the Earth from the top down and seeing that the Arctic is a circle and kind of one nation if you look at it from that way, though there are many nations underneath it. And there's a lot of similarities in culture, and I've been very surprised being with my peers. I'm half American, half Danish, so just connecting the dots that, wow, people in Alaska and Canada actually share a lot with people on this side of the world. And that's so cool that something like sport can connect that and create those connections. So that was one thing where I just never thought of the circumpolar nation, if I should call it that.
That's true. And often people forget, we talk a lot about the Arctic at the moment, but it's often linked to military power or resources. But we often forget that there's actually people living in the Arctic, and there has been people living there for thousands of years. We have family relations across Canada and Alaska and Greenland. When I say family, it's because we often joke with that our cousins live in Canada. Because when I go to Canada, I remember I went to Canada with the Arctic Winter Games when I was a child myself. Or I was maybe 15 or 14. And I knew that there were people in Canada looking like us and almost speaking the same language. And I went to Canada with the Arctic Winter Games, and it was such a big surprise. It was like seeing people that looked like me in a different country, because we always compared ourselves to Scandinavia and Denmark. And suddenly I saw there were people that were using the beats the way we do it in our national costume. They were eating fish the way we were, the way we are eating fish. They were almost speaking the same language. And it was just, wow. It was a big feeling of, wow, we are not alone. And that was the first time I really realized that we have been split by national boundaries between countries, but we are actually related to each other, and there's we share the same culture. That was a big eye opening, and the jewelry they wear were the same that I had when I was a child, and the storytelling.
It's the same. I mean, I went on Google Maps to take a look for myself, and you can't even see from that perspective. You can't zoom in to see the north. It's blocked by the search bar. You can't see that it's actually all connected. And there's someone here who's from Canada, and that's 2 hours away by plane from Nuuk. It's very close.
It's very close. It's the closest country, but we have been divided by two, by the U.S. and Canada, the northern part of America, and then we kind of belonging to Europe, but not geographically, because we were colonized by Denmark. And I remember as a child, when I realized that we had our cousins in Canada, I thought to myself, this is so interesting, because there's actually indigenous peoples living around the world. And then I started looking into that. So when I went to high school, I started to focus already back then on indigenous peoples around the world. And what I realized was that we had so much in common. And often we just compared ourselves every time with a Western community. And it always seemed like the Greenlandic was a kind of a deficit culture. And I was like, this is all wrong, because we're not even supposed to compare ourselves in that way. And it's like the things that we measure a society from is not the things that I would like to be measured from being an indigenous population. And I always heard when I went to Denmark, oh, you have so many social problems in Greenland. And I was like, well, yeah, we do. And then I started looking into that. Why is that? And then I realized that many indigenous populations have the same struggles as we have, but also realizing there's a reason for it. It's not like it came out of the blue, and it's not like it's our culture from back then. And that's why I decided to study sociology, and in particularly study indigenous peoples within sociology. And therefore, I also went to Australia to live to study indigenous peoples in Australia. Actually, I was supposed to go to Canada, and they said, oh, we'll pay for your studies if you go to Canada. And I said, listen, I have been called my whole life. I'm not going to go to Canada. I'm going to go somewhere else. And then I went to Australia. And I realized there that we are not alone. Not only focusing on the struggles, but understanding that when I met the Aborigines in Australia, I realized that They were also struggling with high suicide rates. They were struggling with domestic violence, with abuse, and all those things that were not part of the traditional culture, but actually happened because they were taking away their responsibility for their own lives. And I look back in at our Greenlandic culture, and I realized that back then you were just forced to survive, and you took so much responsibility for surviving and doing good for your family. And then this different notion of life, of capitalism, I don't want to sound like it's all wrong, I'm not saying that, but it just came into, we need to make the Greenlandic more efficient, because that was actually what the Danish state thought. They were saying, ooh, this is too expensive to have them living like hunters and etc. We need to make them efficient, catching seals and whales, etc., for them to sell it to Europe. And when you have so different notions of life actually smashing into each other, the weaker part is always going to have the most bruises. And we did. There were many good things that came with that, education, etc. But I really, truly believe that when you take responsibility out of the hands of people, they become passive and they become...
You're not an active participant in your destiny. Or
no, you're kind of putting your life in someone else's hands, yeah. And you're saying, what should I do? You almost become what I say is a victim, because you're taking away your power. And if you're not reclaiming that power in your life and not always thinking that we come from a deficit culture, then it's going to stay that. And that's when I realized that mental health and having a strong belief in your culture and where you come from is the most important part for a society to survive apart from food. So there's this Maslow pyramid where you say it's important to have food, yes, but once your stomach is full and your body is warm, then you need to have trust in where you come from, and you need to know that you have strength within you. But if you have been taking that strength away, you need to rebuild that strength. And that is actually what is needed in Greenland, without just sitting and staring in the pot saying we should go back and it was all wrong. But no, just looking at it now and say, where are we now? How can we build this strength within each young person in Greenland, so each young person feels that they come from something that is worth presenting? They don't feel that they're always lacking something compared to Western societies, but they truly have something to offer in this world where you're looking for sustainable solutions. So instead of looking at, we're not doing this and that, I remember Sila also said this in her opening speech, maybe some of the things that made us survive back then, solutions were very technical and very well thought through, take some of those tools and initiatives and way we survived, and see if we can use them in sustainable solutions in the future. And also going back and saying, okay, we lift off nature. Right now we are moving in a direction where a lot of young people are experiencing diabetes too in Greenland. We've never had that disease before, and suddenly it's like it's exploding. We're drinking soft drinks all day. Our teeth are getting worse and worse. And when you go back and start to say, well, there's nothing wrong with eating fish. Fish is what we got. We got some of the best fish in the world. We need to make that accessible for all people in the community. Because what is happening now is also that we have a very high equality in Greenland. Which means that when people say in Greenland, oh, we go and hunt and we go and fish. Yeah, maybe you do that in the settlements, but you have to remember one thing. That's a privilege for the rich people in the cities, because it's expensive to have a boat. It's expensive to go out to fish and hunt. So the people that have less resources, I know what they go and buy at the store or at the shop. They go and buy chickens imported from Denmark, where you buy 5 chickens for a very low price. But that chicken is not nourishing or is filled up with chemicals and medicine. And that way they always get the worst food instead of getting the food that is just next to them in the ocean. So for me, it's very important to say we need to make sure that all parts of the Greenlandic society have access to the resources, the food that is from within Greenland. And I know this is also a problem in Nunavut, where I went to a shop and I wanted to buy traditional Inuit food, and they said, no, they don't have that, it's too expensive, they're not able to sell it. And that's where I think one of the solutions is actually going back to look at what were we living off. We were living off seal, we were living off fish, and we were living off berries and all those things, and make them something you want to eat again, something you're proud of eating, something that is full of vitamins, etc. So I like when there comes new initiatives, putting those products forward again and saying, this is actually part of the solution, and not just jumping on the Western notion of now you have to be a vegan. And exactly like they also talked about at the opening ceremony, I have been around the world living there, and everyone say, oh, you eat meat. And I'm like, yeah, do eat meat. And I do eat a lot of fish, because vegetable is not something that is
available here. It doesn't grow.
And it's very expensive, and it's not sustainable. So actually, I have come to the conclusion, when I go into the shop, before that, I did not think about it. I could buy a pineapple from Argentina in February month, the month of February, and I would be like, now I think, no, I don't want to buy that. That has been on a ship, on a plane, and it has cost so much CO2 that it would not be sustainable for me to buy that pineapple. I think it's time to go back and live by the seasons. And if I want to buy vegetables, at least I buy the vegetables that are in season in my closest country, which could be Iceland or Denmark, because that's where we get our food from. So instead of buying the pineapple, maybe I need to buy the apple from Denmark that is in season. So always trying to think of that, and then go back and see, what did we eat before? I remember, like, just because I've always been very focused on food, I was 10 years old when I decided that I would not buy or eat any imported food or any meat from outside. And I've not done that since, because I was very idealistic when I was a child. I was like, oh my God, this is how they treat animal. And I was like, oh, and my mother said, okay, calm down. And I was like, well, I made my decision. And so back then, a lot of people said to me, oh, you don't eat chicken, you don't eat pork, you don't eat this. And I was like, no, because I think you should eat what you can find in nature. Back then, people thought I was really a strange person. I could go to cafes and restaurants here in Nuuk, and I could not buy one single piece of caribou or reindeer. I could not buy fish. I could not buy any local products. Today, I see that when I go to a restaurant, I can buy local products. And I get so happy, because this is the way we should go forward. When I come to a country, if I visit, for instance, Pakistan, I don't want to sit there and eat a burger. I want to eat what's traditional there and what is in season for there. I don't want to eat imported food. And I think we are all starting to look the same when it comes to food. I'm not saying that we should not drink coffee in Greenland. I love my coffee. But just considering, where do you get it from? Is it fair trade? Are we having an equal trade with the countries that do not have the resources that we have? Or actually, they do have the resource, but we benefit from their resources. And going back to that, and I actually also think that COVID was trying to tell us that maybe it's time to step back, look at what do we have in this country. I remember a lot of people here in Greenland then went on staycation, and I was like, yes, because this is actually the notion that we need. What's in your country? There's so many fantastic things. You don't need to go to Dubai to drink a Starbucks before you are doing something that is interesting. Step back, take a look at the local products, and then you look, then you actually have sustainable solutions.
There's a lot of richness in what you just said, and I think that it's been extremely fascinating to understand how important food is this week and how that does relate so much to mental health and to education and to well-being, because it's something that people here have been living off of the land for 4,500 years sustainably. That's crazy. Like when you see the environment and the harshness, and they are very respectful of the food and where it comes from. But at the same time, you see that fighting colonization is hard and it's at all angles and all ways. And I've had a feeling the whole week that it's not too late. It's still possible to still maintain the culture and the heritage foods and many of the other heritage traditions. And at this opening ceremony that you mentioned, we were early introduced to this idea of sila, which I will try explaining and you can add on. But sila being the weather, but also the idea that it is everything, like it is the state of mind. It's the connectedness of the ecosystem. And we are what we eat, which is another word we learned. Kala liminik, you'll have to correct me.
That's right.
But the idea that the word for what you eat, what you consume is literally your identity. So that what I'm eating, my food from here, is what makes me who I am, that I am not separate from nature. I am not separate from the environment. I am one, which is, again, so important when it comes to climate change and understanding that we are not better than nature. We are not above nature. And there's all these other questions that have come up this week around progress and development and modernization. And can you develop faster than the pace of nature? And I think Sila, who you mentioned, Sila Watt, Cloutier, she was a Nobel Peace Prize nominee and the former chair of the ICC. She talked a lot about that we will not develop, we will develop or we will heal ourselves at the pace of empathy and trust. So we have been in small working groups, all of us young people, and it's been a mix of different nationalities. And I had, before I came to speak to you, I've just been going around asking my peers, what was your key takeaway this week? What are you going home with? And the Indigenous peoples who are with us said that it was just very wonderful and beautiful to have a space to talk. And that for many of us coming from more Western places, this has been a space to try and listen more and really see and understand what is happening here and where can we find solutions that are grounded in from here. Like you mentioned, that there's been a long history of innovation, spelled I-N-N-U, like the Inuit, yeah. Not innovation. With the kayak, with building houses out of ice, so many things where you just can't even imagine someone figured out to live here for 4,500 years, even the foods and how complex they are and fermentation and whatnot. But it's a lot about listening and not coming in with the assumption that you know. And I know that right now, Greenland's role is so important. It is the scientific laboratory of the world. It's where we're understanding climate change. The ocean here is warming 3 times faster than anywhere else. Like it's there is a big threat happening quickly to culture. And then what happens? You know, what happens when you can no longer do what your people have always done? So I know that's a lot of different things, and your what you said sparked a lot in me, but that's been very much, we've been talking about all these things this week. And that notion of sila and how interconnected, I've been working on sustainable fisheries, but that's super linked to education and mental health and well-being. It's not separate. And that really grounded for me how important food is in connecting all of it.
Yes. And food is also a way, from a sociological perspective, food is also a way of telling a story. I mean, everything you put in your mouth is actually a choice that you think you have made on your own. But you are so influenced by what is around you. That's also why when you bring in food from the Western, like sugar and alcohol and coffee and tea and all those things back 200 years ago, everyone was thinking that's the luxury goods. Those are the things you want. Those are the things that are linked to power. So back then, it was like a competition of getting those things. And still, they are very dominant because there's so much of it. And actually, something is also quite addictive. Some of it was actually good. I mean, like the vegetables, etc. But some of it was also too dominant. And today, I think it's also a matter of regaining this pride of what is in the country already, like the local products. And I think that the people like us, we do have a lot of resources and we need to show the way. because this is also a matter of education and having. I know that the people that do not have a lot of money, they can afford to buy good local products. But we have to show the way. So a lot of people are starting to use local products. So it's actually going to be cheaper. And it also has to do a lot to do with education, because the educational level here in Greenland is not as high as in Scandinavia and Canada, etc. But often people do not know what is healthy and what is not healthy. They think, okay, I give this pop soda or just a sugary drink to my child and the child will be happy, but they don't know what it's actually doing to the child. And I think we need to bring a lot more of information and pride into our traditional food and saying, well, you should try to take a step back and actually use what you have already in the community. And I think that it's also for many, many years, the humans have always wanted to take power over nature.
Yes.
This is like we're thriving to just see if we can control everything, because mm-hmm. that's what we want to do. And I know I want to try to control everything too. But maybe it's time to say there are some things that we cannot control unless we go along with what it's trying to tell us. And yeah. right now, the earth is trying to tell us, you're abusing me. And as long as you are taking more than you are giving back, then you're leaving the next generation with in a worse condition. And that is actually what is happening now. So we need to step back and think of the next generation saying, do we give enough back? I've always been taught, if you come into, it doesn't matter if it's a job or it's a project or whatever you do, think of it this way. Are you leaving it in a better condition than when you arrived, than you have done good? It doesn't matter if it's much better or it's just a little bit better, as long as you have done something better for the next one to come in or the next generation. And that's what we have to start thinking about. And that obviously, as every parent in this world, became very obvious for me when I had my own children. It was like, wow, is this what we are giving on to the next generation? Yeah. I get scared and I also get hopeful, because I do realize that a lot of things are happening now, and a lot of young people are also, much further ahead than the rest of us. I mean, I am about soon turning 50 in a couple of years, and then the younger generation say, stop a moment, this is not how we should do things. We need to do this differently, and there are more sustainable ways, and we are not eating this because this is transported from the other part of the world. And I'm like, good on you. Thank you for showing the way. So it's time to look back at what is the earth telling us? What is the youth telling us? And maybe looking at new solutions.
Yeah. One of the words I also learned here that we have heard repeatedly is imaka, which is like saying maybe, but from what I understand, it derives even more from maybe, because we don't know if the weather's going to allow it. Exactly. So you might want to meet me tomorrow at 9, but it's pretty harsh here. Like, you can't control the weather. It has its own mind. And that idea that you're in the, you have to kind of bow down to nature. It's not your prerogative or your decision. You have to go with the flow of whatever the environment allows. And that's been also a super interesting teacher this week in terms of, you can't control it.
Exactly. The nature is really a teacher in that sense. And I grew up with this. I have been stuck the most remote places for many days. The longest I have been stuck was 2 weeks when I was a child. And you just get to know, okay, imaka. Perhaps who, or it's actually, let's see. And that affects the whole culture. I mean, there could be circumstances that could change, and you would go imaka. And especially when I worked within aviation, it was very interesting to see how people that are in Greenland, they always understood if the weather is bad, we're not flying. But I had customers from all over the world. And I, in particular, remember this couple coming from I think they were from Switzerland, and they came, and it was a storm outside, and they were at the airport, and they said, we want to fly now. And we said, well, look out the window. We're not flying anywhere. And they were like, but I want to be on the next plane out of this country. And it was like, you are on the next plane out of this country. But right now, there's something that is bigger than us. And that's the weather. And you can't control the weather. But if you live in Switzerland and you're used to going to Hamburg every other day at 6:29, then you think you can control everything. But the weather is actually controlling us, which is also something that is influenced the other way that we are living with each other. I work for UNICEF now, and my boss came yesterday and she said, it's really amazing how relaxed you are here in Greenland. It's like you just go with the flow, and you're having this crown princess visiting you, and you're just saying, let's see what happens. Let's take it and let's flow with it. And she said, oh, it's so much more nice. And you just, let's see, immaka, we'll see. And there was a lot of changes in the program. And we were like, well, you know what? We grew up with changes in the program every single day. So you kind of become more adaptive and you become more like flexible. And what is needed in the world is people that are more flexible and adaptive, but also understands that maybe we can't do this. Maybe we need to do something differently. We have come to live like we want to control everything. And this is how I've always done things. And I'm not going to do anything differently because, of course, I'm allowed to have my vegetables from South America and have my ribeye from Argentina. I've always done that. Well, listen up. Maybe you need to do some changes. So it's a matter of always also doing the personal changes and not just making it into words, because that's what often happens. I sometimes go to conferences where I sit there and I get so fed up with just words, because I'm like, start with something concrete, because it can be just talk and talk and talk. And sometimes you have to think, yes, but where do we start? And that's where the youth come in, because you have other ways of being concrete, and also children. We work with children. And last year we had this annual meeting with children from all over Greenland. And they were talking about for a whole week about biodiversity and CO2 reduction. And they came up with recommendation for the municipalities and also for the government here in Greenland. And they were five concrete suggestions, solutions, and one of them was like, instead of buying new clothes all the time here in Greenland, we import everything. We would like that more people traded clothes, because we throw so much out and it just goes out in the garbage and then we forget about it. And they actually themselves arranged this clothes-changing day among all the high schools. We didn't do it. They did it themselves.
That's so cool.
The other thing was they said, we should eat more local food and we have to make sure that everyone has access to the local food. And this is how we're going to do it. So it becomes concrete and something you can actually do.
Mm.
So yeah, that's what's needed in the future.
Yeah. I'd love to ask you the questions that everyone on the podcast gets asked now, and it's also related to the future. The first is, what is your vision for the future of food?
My vision is that let me put it this way. The most important thing is that we do not take more food and nutrition out of this world than we are giving back. So mm-hmm. we need to make sure there's enough nutrition and food for the future generation. We need to go back and look at what is in our region, what is local food, understanding that there are limitations to what we should eat and not thinking it's a privilege and a right to eat food from all around the country. It's not sustainable to fly in caviar to the Saudi Arabia. Maybe you should learn to live with limitations. Maybe limitations are all right. And then we need to go back and look at wholesome food, something that is you can find like local products, and maybe just also building some pride within cultural indigenous products, and not thinking that we should live the same all around the world. It's not everyone who should eat bread the rest of their life and drinking Coke. We need to understand that we live in a different world, and obviously that comes with different food.
Yeah. Preservation of culture is so important. And when we arrived, yes, we were also introduced to the fact that the superpower up here is listening. And that's very much in the culture. And while it may be off-putting when you're from a place where we're talking all the time and we're animated and we're loud and we talk over each other and interrupt each other, it's not that people don't have anything to say. It's just that they're listening and they need more space and more quiet and more reflection. And are we creating room for that too?
Exactly. It gives me this thought. My mother, she was a teacher, and she said she was coming from another elementary school in Copenhagen, where she moved to Greenland. And the first 2 years, she was just so puzzled. She said, but they're not saying anything. Maybe they don't think of anything. Maybe they don't have an opinion about anything. And then she realized that they were reflecting, and they did not have the Greenlandic children did not have the need to hear themselves. And it was not a competition of who could be the loudest. And when you understand that, that's also something very important when you work with different people or with other cultural background. Understand you have one mouth, but you have two ears. So open that ears and understand what is not being said as well.
Yeah. And I want to build on that, because another big theme with the education track has been that many people from around the world come here, especially scientists, to study. And they were described as geese, meaning they come for the warm months of summer and then leave in the winter. But very often they don't incorporate local knowledge in the solutions they're looking for related to technology, progress, everything else. And what would it look like to incorporate that intuitive local knowledge of the land for so many years and just integrate the two? So I know there's people working on that. But I found that so interesting, because before I came, I read a history of the Arctic exploration and how that led to being a big scientific laboratory and why Greenland's so important here and now. And they said that consistently throughout, much of that exploration and that science wouldn't have been possible without the Greenlanders and the people that lived here. And that it is their ability to see a polar bear wearing the distance long before it's upon you. But if you're not used to that and seeing that, you can't. They know how to live in the cold. They know how to do so many things that you would never know how to do if you came here from experience. So that has also struck me as being so important, is our ability to listen and to integrate and not come in and assume or to put our culture on another place. I know it's cross-cultural communication 101, mm-hmm. but you know, you can really feel it. You're like, mm-hmm. okay, I can't come in with my assumption that there should be a McDonald's here and I should be mm-hmm. able to eat a burger and fries. Yeah. That's also okay that there is no McDonald's here.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And maybe when you visit a new country or a new culture, I always think it's a good thing to have what is called a beginner's mind.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And not taking anything for granted, but be curious and just saying, wow, I wonder what they do. I wonder what they eat. Instead of saying, compared to back home.
Yes.
Always comparing, just saying, okay, this is really different. Different things can be scary to us people. We don't like things that are different because we can't control that. But if you allow yourself to be in that area where everything is new, you also see different things, and you—that's where your whole brain is whitening, or your whole mind is growing. So that beginner's mind, I think, is also something that we have to start with in order to live sustainably in the future.
And I have to build, we talked a lot about food heritage, but another big topic is language heritage. Mm-hmm. And that's been something too with education, but also mental health and well-being, and even food, is the ability to keep speaking your mother tongue.
Mm-hmm.
And how you even see it around the university, that there's signs of many people here speak Danish and Greenlandic. But it's important that even as kids, those classes are in Greenlandic. And you mentioned that you should be able to go study in, no, you didn't mention that, but a lot of children here will go study in Denmark for a higher education. And I watched a documentary on the plane about the Sume band. Mm-hmm. You know them?
Yes.
They were the first to coin the word for oppression in Greenlandic, mm-hmm. and came out with like a revolutionary album in the 70s that resonated with the people. And it was very much like poetry, giving voice to a lot of emotions. But there is one quote of the lead singer where he says, "We were forced to choose between an education or our culture." And that just, it really stuck with me. Like, how unfair that you can't have both.
Yeah.
I've never been in that position, but education's
right.
important. Language is important. Culture is important.
And my father was one of them who had to just choose between culture and education. And I remember how much struggle that created in his life later on. Mm. That, by the way, that movie always makes me cry, because I think we are still there in some sense. And I also find that often people come here still and they presume, of course you should understand Danish. And you're like, why? Why do you presume that? It's because we're part of the Danish kingdom, but our culture is so different. And when you forget that, that's when, it's always when you start presuming, right? You think you know something.
Yeah, we say in English, when you assume, you make an ass out of you and me, which spells the word assume.
That is so good.
Yeah. It's funny.
Yeah.
But very much that you should never assume anything.
Exactly.
And they've been pushing us hard in this Innovation Week to be like, is that an assumption you come with?
Yeah.
Or a fact or an insight? Like, where does that, what is the origin of that thought?
Exactly.
Where does it come from within you?
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. And I think just to also mention education here, Royal Greenland, which is the big fishery, is government owned and the biggest employer in all of Greenland. And the fishermen and the hunters are very much cultural bearers. Mm-hmm. So going back to education and the ability to both treat the ability to teach the trade and something that your people have done forever. But then also I'm very much balancing what you said of the holistic perspective of being and living in nature, but also progress. And do we live within ecological limits or do we try to invent more? Like, these two things we're balancing. And when you're at an innovation seminar, it's of course coming up the two tensions all the time. But yeah, that's been also so important to me, is the education aspect of the people that work our land and who supply our food and make that possible.
And what is also important in the future is that you don't have to do that choice between education and culture, but actually that those two things can be combined in a beautiful way, which I've heard some of the groups are also working at. I remember when I was a child, we were reading about the harvest in Denmark and the mjöl, which is beer in Danish, and we're like, what is that? And obviously we need to know about those things, but often you also need to have, or you actually need to have education and education related to your culture in order to make it, make you understand it and use it in your everyday life. So it's not a matter of now I'm being a cultural person doing hunting and fishing and now I'm going to school and it's completely different. That's when you start also working with splitting identities, because it should be possible to have those united in Greenland and among indigenous peoples, and also being proud of bringing in their culture in the educational system. But also it becomes often a matter of science always win or have a very dominant power over culture. I mean, but scientifically we can see this and that. Yeah, but sometimes your numbers is not showing what's going on. Open your eyes and look outside the window, observe, and you might see something completely different. I've also read a book where it's a doctor. You go to the doctor and what is happening is that you cannot see a fraction on the bone, and you say, there's nothing wrong with you. But if the doctor actually look at the patient, he can see that the food is in the complete wrong direction, but he doesn't have the awareness to actually look at the food. He just looks at the x-ray, and it's like, well, open your eyes and see what's out there. And understand also the interrelation between people.
Yeah. And that splitting of the identity or the inability to be yourself, to be your culture, to be who you are and what has been, is also what leads to mental health issues and leads to suicide and the ability to not just not feel permission to be. Like, yeah. I think that's also super rooted in all of it. And yeah. that's also been, you can hear how everything's interconnected. Yes. Like, there's not one thing without the other.
Yeah.
And when you think of this vision for the future and the future of food, what do you think we're missing to get there and to make that a reality?
I think it's called modesty. Mm. And I think it's called limitations. Not always wanting more and bigger, but maybe less is more. And joy with just missing out as well. And the beauty of the nature, really focusing on that.
Yeah. And we didn't talk too much about your work, but we do have listeners of this show from about 80 countries around the world. And I always say you never know where a solution or a good idea can come from. So are there any collaborations or help you're looking for, things where you would love, or just it could also be something you want people to know, but any ask of a boomerang that might come back to you later on?
I would really like to have more focus on young people's well-being in the future. They predict that depression and anxiety, etc., is the most our worst enemy in the future for the younger generation, and in particularly also for Indigenous peoples. I would like to have more people focusing and understanding how important mental health is for surviving, having a good life. We're not only surviving, we're also living. And I would like to have more people and more power and more focus on mental health, because yeah. apart from food, this is very important in the future for a sustainable world.
Mm-hmm. But it's resilience. If you don't have a resilience ecosystem, biodiversity to live off of, and you don't have resilience in yourself, then
exactly.
what do you have?
Exactly.
And then finally, I mean, if anyone has a super good idea or is interested, what's the best way to get in touch or get involved with mental health in this regard? And
I think a good way is always looking at your society around you. Always try to understand your society first before you make solutions for other people. And for Greenland and for me personally, I would like to work with that in the future. And in UNICEF, we are working a lot with that. And I hope we can have a whole, network of people working with mental health in Greenland and other Arctic Inuit or actually Indigenous people's communities.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for coming on and sharing your perspective and helping to connect these dots. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, that's all for today. So what were your thoughts on this episode? I'd love to hear them. Feel free to shoot me a message on LinkedIn or Instagram or email me at nordicfoodtechpodcast@gmail.com. If you really liked it, consider becoming a patron and supporting the show for a few dollars every month. The link to do so is in the show notes or visit www.nordicfoodtech.io. Your contribution will make all the difference and enable me to tell more good stories about how we're creating a better future through food. Thanks again for listening, and I'll see you next time.